The Ensemble podcast is intended for professional financial advisors. All discussion is limited to publicly available information and should not be interpreted as legal, professional, or financial advice. Ensemble does not hold an AFS license nor provide any financial services. Before making investment decisions, you should obtain financial advice from a qualified financial advisor.
Hi, I'm Andrew Rocks, and welcome to the Ensemble Licensee podcast series. Ensemble is all about the positive evolution of financial advice and the ecosystem that is advice has the advisor, who we support voraciously. It has the practice, who via the engine room have had their moment in the sun, but the missing link was the licensee. It was not just a risk framework, but a go-forward organisation, as big and small, that put the foundation down to allow all of that to happen. So strap in and enjoy the Ensemble Licensee podcast series. Cheers.
For over 25 years, PM Capital has taken the road less travelled, delivering a disciplined, high-conviction approach to global investing and uncovering opportunities often overlooked by conventional investment strategies. Their Global Companies Fund has significantly outperformed the MSCI World Index since inception, driven by deep research, patience, and alignment with clients. In today's changing landscape, they offer clarity and conviction to help build more resilient portfolios. Learn more at www.pmcapital.com.au/explore.
Hello, I'm Andrew Rocks, and welcome to another edition of the Licensee podcast series. I'm here on a Friday afternoon, so be warned, everyone. That's the disclaimer that I'm putting out, and I'm face-to-face with a charming chap who's we've already had plenty of laughs. In fact, I hope we actually can extract some out of the podcast. We might hopefully haven't used them all up. But I'm here today with Rob Coit, who's the CEO of Chartry Wealth. Welcome to the podcast, Rob.
G'day, Roxy. How are you?
I'm bloody fine. I'm fine. We're going to have a bit of fun here. There's some interesting overlapping backstories between us. I don't think we ever met when we were young. And if I did, it would be you probably running over me in a game of football. So, but let's get into sort of what you've built, the way in which you go about things, but probably the elephant in the room. I'm going to say it up front. So everyone is listening, Rob Coit and Andrew Rocks, if you went onto both of our LinkedIn photos right now, there's crimes that have been committed. So I think after this, both of us will have to go and update the photos, but maybe we won't, Rob. Maybe it's optical.
I think it's probably time.
It might be time. So let's kick off with you're Sydney based, but you grew up in the bush. Is that right?
Yeah, I grew up in the bush. Dad was a school teacher. Mum was a stay at home mum, one of four kids. And Dad dragged us all around the state as kids, never stayed anywhere for too long.
In New South Wales?
In New South Wales.
Okay.
So
how many schools did you go to?
Half a dozen.
Okay. That's interesting. And how do you think that has impacted your ability to make like friends?
I think per se, anyone from the bush finds it very easy to make connections because you actually have to.
Yeah, scarcity.
Yeah, I mean, well, when you go to school with everyone, the mechanics kids, the lawyers kids, the doctors kids, the farmers kids. You know, you can't have your little cliques because there's not enough people to have cliques.
Correct. And half the time you're in composite classes where you're in with way bigger kids as well, so they sort you out.
Correct.
So you've travelled around, why didn't you become a teacher?
Well, my dad was a maths teacher. His dad was a maths teacher.
Wow.
So I was always thought that I'd become a financial planner.
Oh, no. Right, okay. Well, without sort of putting an age on you, given that you graduated school the same year that I did, financial planning wasn't even a twinkle in a career's eye.
It was not.
So what was your education, your first sort of education that you did?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, as you sort of said, like we had some crossover at our school days when basically, you know, I thought playing football was all there was to sort of life. And then, of course, you know, drinking beer and having fun with the boys. And then when I finished year 12, it was, well, what are you going to do with yourself? And I had no idea, as many kids didn't. And I sort of thought to myself, well, if I can save people tax or make people money, someone's got to be willing to pay for that service.
Yep.
So I ended up doing a commerce degree at Newcastle. And after I actually did the first semester, one of my mates from school, his dad was running Coke over in Indonesia, Coca-Cola.
just to clarify.
Yeah. yeah. I said to him, I said, look, this accounting, it's as boring as, and I really don't want to do it. I'm going to go do something else. I'm going to do, you know, marketing or economics history or something like that. And he stopped at me and he looked at me. He said, no, persevere with it. Because once you've got that under your belt, you can go and do whatever you want. And it was great advice. And I did that. And then, of course, when I finished the degree, I decided I wanted to do something around financial markets. So I came down here to Sydney and I worked in Westpac Treasury, sat on FX desks, capital markets desks, did back office stuff, risk management stuff. And then I got a phone call from a mate from school who said, I've just started this business. I've got an accounting firm here in Pitt Street and I'm giving financial advice to their clients. I need help. And he said, you'd love it and you'd be perfect for it. And I said, well, what does it involve? And he says, oh, we talk about things like superannuation and what have you. And I said, what's superannuation?
What year was this? That was my next question.
Yeah,
it was like 95 or 6 or something, was it?
Yeah. It would have been 1996. Yeah, probably.
Yeah, what's super?
Yeah, what's super? And so basically I looked around the trading room and sort of thought, well, this isn't really for me, so I'll give something else a crack. And I took a huge pay cut and away I went. And I've been here
fortuitously would have been within the following 10 years that trading room ceased to exist as well.
It wasn't even that long. It was very quickly.
Yeah.
I always wanted to be the proprietary trader.
Yeah, prop trade. Yeah, yeah.
He had the best job. He sat there, he did nothing, and then he'd walk over and he'd say, I want 50 mil of this, and then he'd sit there for 3 months and then he'd sell it. And I thought, that's a great job.
Yeah, I think you might have to do a bit of experience before you did that, but but nevertheless, I think they turned the lights off a few months. But so you spent 4 years in Westpac. That's a big corporate, and that was and then you've been approached by a friend to say financial advice. You were just sort of saying, well, what does that actually mean? And was that a small business, large business, part of a network? Where was that?
Yeah, it was a startup. So it was basically, he'd sort of got together with an accounting firm, and said, look, I can give financial advice to all of your clients.
Under a dealer's license.
Under a dealer's license. Yeah. And that was back in the old days. Mm. And, and so basically I joined him as his paraplanner, dog's bod, general rouseabout. For my sins, I'm still in. Still here. Still doing the same thing.
Got it. So that was in 2000, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
From webinars to one-on-one sessions, if you're learning, it should be recognised. Record your next activity at cpdcheck.com.
So I got to ask you some questions. So when a client would come in 2000 or 2001 or two, what's the biggest difference in the way in which a client goes through the onboarding process between then and now? And don't say you've got to charge them $5,000 now as opposed to one. But yeah, what do you see as the biggest difference in those 20 years?
Look, to be honest, the approach that we take, and with all credit to the people that I learnt with, they've always had a very holistic approach. So when people sort of say, oh, financial planning's got to be holistic, it's got to be this, it's got to be that, it's like, well, that's what we do.
It's always been that.
Correct. It's been no different.
Yep.
So to me, what we actually did then to what we do now is no different. The tools are different. We've got different potential solutions. We've got a lot broader case of, you know, what we can look to use as weapons.
Yeah.
But the outcome's still the same. What do you want? What are you trying to do? Help people through their options and just go through the process.
And given that you were quite young back then, what were the type of clients that you mainly looked after personally yourself?
Yeah. Well, I actually caught up with my very first client for a lunch just before Christmas.
Oh, wow.
He's about to go into an aged care home. Yeah. So it's been great sort of having connections with people for that period of time and being such an integral part of their lives. And I'll never forget when the GFC happened and I was actually having a conversation with that client. And I mean, at the time of the GFC, I'd still fairly young. I was sort of 30s. And anyway, he sort of came in and he wasn't too phased about anything. And I sort of said to him, I said, what's going on?
When they're more calm than you are.
Yeah, correct. And I said, well, everything's going a bit pear-shaped. It's this and that. And he looked at me and he said, you are now experienced. And that's all he said. And it's true. And those sorts of events, they actually make you as a professional and as a person.
I like to ask people who went through the GFC, and I did, what they learned from it. But I think I think your client articulated it, is that it gives you, I suppose, a depth of thinking about repercussions outside of your control that you just didn't have. Because it was quite bubbly the 3 or 4 years before that, and it almost felt, you almost took for granted the actual skill and client management. And I'm sure someone like that, and having that experience of yourself, meant that you had confidence to talk to other clients who might have been more nervous.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing that it's taught me, which my clients will sort of validate, is I'm very upfront in telling people when it is good times that, yeah, the party's going okay, it's going well, but you don't want to be here at 2 a.m. when they start bringing out the tequila, because things are going to go pear-shaped pretty quick. And we need to make sure that we're positioned to make sure that we're not going to derail what you're actually trying to do.
Yeah.
And what you're trying to do is, you know, in most cases, it's provide an income to keep up with inflation throughout the course of their life.
And so you've had that, and then you, when did you make the move to start your own practice? Because it was 15 years ago or something, was that right?
Yeah, it's longer. It's been 20-odd years.
Yeah.
So basically that firm that I was in Pitt Street, I was meant to become a partner, and politics and what have you came through, and they basically said, you know, we're not going to make him a partner. You can only stay an employee. And at that point, my boss basically said to me, well, I'm not going to hire you as an employee. You're sacked. Go set up your own show. And so at 26, I think I was 26, 27, I remember sitting down with my dad, who was a school teacher, saying, I am now officially self-employed. And he looked at me in horror and said, what the hell are you doing that for?
How much did you pay a month? Nothing.
I said, I'm starting at a very round figure of zero.
Yeah, yeah. And is that bedroom still an offer? Well, you know, it's funny you should say that. Probably people who are listening to this now who are on a promise, right? What I'm finding is that a lot more young people are bringing that forward, because they're probably hearing stories and learning from these sort of historical errors or just missteps, right? It's two sides to every story, but communication's key. I mean, we communicate with our clients pretty well. So you then are self-employed, back to client zero or whatever it was, and that's when you kicked, was it called Proactive through Chartreux Wealth? Is that when you kicked that name?
No, we set up, I set up Centre Capital, basically, and then it went through a few sort of versions. And then I think it was just before the GFC, we were with a large dealer group, and we could sort of see things weren't going that well, and we were a little concerned with how things were panning out. So we made the decision to sort of get our own license.
Yep.
At that juncture, only because, we had a certain way of doing things. It wasn't rocket science, but it was our way. And after interviewing a lot of the licensees, we just felt that, we'll just bite the bullet and we'll just get our own.
Was there one key reason?
It was just the flexibility to do what we wanted to do.
Right.
Like we had to be honest, what I do today is the same thing I did 25 years ago. It hasn't changed, right?
For historical context, licensees were far more rigid quite often.
Oh, absolutely.
And a lot of them were backed by institutions across. So it's chalk and cheese these days, really.
Correct.
We're going to talk about your licensee
in
a minute. But for those younger people listening, it was a really stark choice. I mean, I went self-licensed as well. It had its pitfalls as well. So you go from a support, but maybe not perfect, to no support, but idealistic. And the difference between that is money. You've got to find more money, right?
Yeah, yeah. And time. That's the big one. And what I always say to people, who are thinking about their own license, I'd sort of say, yep, look, it is a solution. But what I would do if I was you is I would go around and I would try to find a licensee that you can work with that will enable you to do what you need to do, because more often than not, if you can find that person, that's way better than doing your own license.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, good advice, right? And so you've been a practicing advisor. You then became the RM, I imagine, of your license. And the business, given the tenure and the longevity of the business, you're obviously taking clients on and whatnot. When did the sort of evolution into a more broader business occur? Was there a moment
Oh, there certainly was. And that was a result of the GFC. So we had an investment in an unlisted property trust, which was called SIA Tays McMahon, which later changed its name to Orchard.
Right.
And it was going pear-shaped and...
Still frozen?
No, unfortunately. If it was still frozen, that'd probably be a good outcome. But basically what happened there was we could see that things weren't going to plan, and we sort of sat around a table with the big licensees at the time who were had money in that investment. And basically we walked out of that meeting saying to ourselves that these guys have got no interest in saving the clients. They're only interested in their own reputational damage. The banks are going to come in, they're going to wind this thing up, and 15,000 mums and dads are going to lose $1 billion.
Yep.
And at that point, we then went to the pub and we had a few, well, it was in Melbourne, so we had a few pints. And then the decision was made, we'll stuff this, we'll do it ourselves. Let's if these guys aren't going to represent people and advisors at the coalface, we'll do it ourselves.
And who was in your band of merry men and women then?
Oh, there was a few of us. You know, some are still there, some have sort of got off the ride. But as a vehicle, I guess that started from, you know, I guess frustration, and a drunken conversation. It was, you know, we can definitely do this better. Yeah. And that's where the whole thing was born from.
And that's like 2009 or 10, is that right?
By the time we got to that point, it was probably more 2011, 2012, because it took years to work through this thing.
Okay. So you've then gone out and got your own license, and then FOFA kicked in.
Yeah.
So the first incarnation of FOFA was 212 from memory, and the Royal Commission was 218 or 219, is that right?
Yeah.
Something like that. But the gestation was an ominous sort of contraction of stuff like that. But before we get into all of that, you moved from, so you did high school in Tamworth, and then you moved straight down to Sydney, or?
No. I went to the Big Smoke first. I moved to Newcastle to go to uni.
Right. Okay. We went to Newcastle University, which I also went as well. So both of our qualifications are questionable. What do you do outside of work?
At the moment, I've got kids, play a bit of golf.
Are your kids all grown up, or?
No, the oldest has just left school and starting to figure out what the real world means, and the youngest one's year six.
Yeah, so you're still straddling. You've got clients in that who are empty nesting and retired, but you can identify with clients who have got younger kids doing high school as well, right?
So, oh, absolutely. And the best thing about this job, right, is when, and I say this often to clients when I'm sitting there talking to them, the playbook that I've put together for my advice, it's not me putting it together from a book or something I learned at Newcastle University in between trips to the bar on the hill. It's through the culmination of talking to many, many people and their experiences.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Which is exactly the same as what Ensemble's trying to do by talking to advisors and these podcasts in general. So then you're managing, you're wrangling kids, you're living life. And what does Chartreux look like today? Because we're now 12 years, 13 years on from that moment. What does the business look like today? And then I'm going to ask a few questions about some of your lessons.
Lessons. Well, that could be another episode in itself.
We can just speed it up, can't we, Kieran? Yep, he's nodding. So, but we do definitely want that because you learn from your own mistakes.
Correct.
And the cheaper mistakes to learn from are other people's.
Correct. If you're smart enough to do that.
So let's start with what does the licensee look like today, just as an overview?
Yeah, so an overview. We've got about 60 advisors all throughout Australia, and we've got, I guess when I sort of coming back to that, why did we set up a license? We set the license up so we could effectively advocate for clients and for advisors that needed advocation. What we're also about is at the time we set it up, you may remember there was a lot of, oh, they're going to get rid of licensing. They're going to make everyone self-licensed.
Yeah.
Right? So people go, well, why do you want to do that? And I said, well, the goal is... What we want to be able to do for people is actually, rather than just you join and you tick a box because you have to and you pay money for it, we actually want to be there and we want to give them support and provide services that they see as valuable. So whether they're licensed themselves or they're licensed through us, Yeah. If we're doing a good job, they're still going to see the value of us. So I always took the approach that the licensee was there to do things that as an advisory firm, you couldn't do on your own. So one of the things that always gets me about advisors is they're always trying to reinvent the wheel, right? We're all sitting around coming up with the best ways to do this and do that, and we're all doing the same thing. Now, my job as a licensee is to go through that process. Their job as advisors is to not be doing that and to be sitting down with mum and dad and actually doing what means to be done. And then we come with our findings and say, look, this is what we find. What does everyone think? You know, blah, blah, blah. So that was the way that I always viewed the licensee approach. More than just the usual, you know, you need a ticket to play. If you sign up with us, you've got your ticket.
And I'm just, as you're saying, I'm cross-referencing your 2026 elevator pitch to yourself against your website's core values and why you did things. And you almost read it word for word. So
you'd be pretty happy.
After gaining an AFSL, Chartreux began documenting, symbolising core advice principles and practices. In delivering our support, we're focused on empowering advisors to focus on what they do best, providing a platform for our advisors to be compliant in running their business, and provide outstanding support to enable our advisors to operate efficiently. And I think over here, you've mentioned that in our view, a dealer group, which is old school, has only one business motive. It should have authorized representatives providing financial advice to public at a level that not only satisfies the laws, but is ethical. And that all comes back to the catalyst or the genesis of why you kick this business off. And when we're asking about lessons, I'm going to ask you about some of the lessons that you've learned in that journey, right? Because just because you've made advisors' lives easier doesn't mean they're all going to follow the path.
No.
It can be frustrating. So what are some of the lessons that you've learned over 10 years with that as a foundation to where you are now?
Yeah. Well, what just picking up on that point that you've just made, and that's exactly right. So what we're actually doing within the business now is we're actually sort of segmenting, if you will, the advisors in the group. So we're separating the ones that, you know, we're providing a certain level of standards to, but they want to sort of, or services rather, but they want to go do their own thing in certain other areas. But what we've also got is we've got a best of breed concept.
What do you call that?
We call it best of breed.
Right.
And we call it the Chartreux way. And the Chartreux way is all about, as I said, getting away from reinventing the wheel, right? It's just this works. This is the process. It's scalable. And furthermore, if an advisor is implementing the Chartreux way, they're going to get far superior outcomes for their clients. So it's how they operate their business. It's how they manage the money. It's how they do all of these things, right?
So you're leaning into the business of the business, not just the governance and licensee requirements.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. And of your 60 advisors, as you mentioned, there are quite a few that are doing their own thing and they're
Correct.
Dipping in there. But what's the sort of percentage that are either involved in that best practice or your practice? So it's best of breed, Chartreux way.
Yep. So some people are doing more than others.
Yeah.
But what we actually have had is we had a couple of advisors who did embrace basically say 100%.
Yep.
And we've got a few more that are still doing it at the moment. And out of those advisors that did it, we then basically we provided a way for business succession and we actually bought those businesses.
Okay. So we're going to unpack that. So fundamentally, you've when an advisor comes to you or a practice comes to you, they get onboarded, and we're going to talk about the sort of practices that you've got and that you attract. And then at some stage, either yourself or whoever's doing the practice development says, well, we've got this best of breed and this is what it looks like at 100% and we'd like to take you through it. And the byproduct of doing all of that, apart from efficiency, is that you as the business owner get a good look at them. And you're like, well, if they're doing it this way, then we'd feel very comfortable deploying our capital and our risk appetite and helping them out. And quite often, that could be an advisor who needs a strategy for exit because it could be a sort of a smaller business. Is that right?
Correct.
So how do, like, isn't he got a couple of examples of how that's played out?
Yeah, absolutely.
So
in the last 12, 18 months, we've done two businesses.
Yep.
I did one business. Another advisors did the other business, but then that sort of didn't work out. So I had to go in and take that one as well. So in the last 12 months, I've taken on two businesses, and the only way that is humanly possible is because of two reasons. Fundamentally, the clients were structured in a way that I'm familiar with.
Yep.
And yeah, most of those clients are invested in the same products, the same strategy. They've been, yeah, it's risk profiling, everything else, it's the same. So basically, I can go into a cold meeting and I can basically know where these guys are at.
Yep.
Right. And then the second part is I've got an administration team who basically knows how things work, and they can, I'm conducting the meetings and they're basically just doing everything else.
So from a hygiene perspective, does that mean that you guys have like tripartite agreements with banks for lending, et cetera?
Yep.
I've asked the last couple of people because I'm always curious, which are the banks that you sort of see popping up that are doing a good job in financial services?
Yeah, I think we deal with NAB a bit. So I also understand that, there's a couple of other players, but primarily we've dealt with NAB.
Yeah, no, just always curious because it's, another part of people listening to this is that we get out there and hopefully then the product providers hear this as well and go, well, if we want to get into their market, we've got something better, right?
The banks have definitely got a better appetite than they did, say, 5 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So you mentioned you've had 60 practices now. What do they look like?
Most of our practices are a 1-2 person operations.
Yep. So a couple of people, like 1 or 2 advisors, and then
support staff.
Support.
Yep. Yep.
Do you help them out with centralized power planning or anything like that? How do we do that?
Yeah, we've got quite a few actually that have joined recently into, as I said, taking up part of the Chartreux way in regards to how they do admin.
Yep.
Right. So we've actually got a back office admin service, and they're basically just, rather than sort of having their own person, and then that person leaves, and then they've got to go and find someone else and then train them up, and then they leave, and yeah, same. We've got a whole team there. And that team also, what the other thing I find with smaller firms is you can afford one resource.
Or half of one.
Or half of
one. Yeah.
So you can get someone who's very, very senior.
Yeah.
Who's going to cost you a lot of money, or you can get someone who's very, very junior and who can't necessarily do a lot. Whereas the model that we've got, we've obviously got a team of people. We've got very senior people in that team. We've got very junior people. So what that enables the team to do is to organize the work around the specific skill sets. And obviously that's just a lot more efficient in regards to, you know, getting the work done at a reasonable cost.
Yeah, and I'm looking at your site here, and they're part of your user paid services as far as, so you've vetted those people. If I'm an advisor in your network and I'm using those third-party providers or associated with you, I'm assuming that they're compliantly approved. You've done a lot of the due diligence, that sort of thing.
Well, they're internal.
They're internal.
And they're the people, those businesses that we bought, they are the back office. They are the reason I was able to just go in and very quickly get those clients on the straight and narrow and without any concerns, because it's the system.
Has there been any geographical strategy as to where your practices come from?
No.
I figured that. He had a furrowed brow when he said that.
Yeah, so I'm a frequent flyer. But the other thing, probably the one good thing that came from COVID is that the way we do business has completely changed.
Yeah.
So if I had have said before COVID that I'm going to buy a business, you know, based in, say, Adelaide, and when I'm in Sydney, and I don't necessarily want to spend more than a few weeks of the year in Adelaide, that would not have been a realistic thing. Now, what we actually have is we struggle to get people in the office. Oh, I'll just do a Zoom. Yeah, that's all right. I've already met Rob. I don't need to see him again. Good looking bloke and all, but Zoom will
surrounded
do the
by
job.
Liars, mate.
Zoom will do the job.
Yeah, look, absolutely. So now that's where you've landed now. But have you got here's another question. So you've got 60 people, advisors, ARs, across what feels like about 30 to 45 practices. Is that right?
Yep.
Across the eastern states, and you've got some other ones in WA, you mentioned. Yep. So plus you're running your own practice, okay? Who's in your team to help you do that?
Well, that gets back to the Chartreux way. So our advice business is the first member of that best of breed model.
Got it.
So we've got 2 advisors in my advice business, but basically all the admin and all the support is provided no differently to it is to other advisors in the best of breed model.
Yeah, okay. And that also extends, you've got some marketing and business development support as well for your practices. And we're going to get to that in a second because we're going to talk about, you know, licensees. There's a way in which they can grow, which is obtaining existing visas from other licensees. But then the sort of the real engine is just getting some of your practices doing to organically grow, bring through.
Yeah.
Now, Roxy,
just before we get onto that, there's two major things that have happened in my work capacity that enable me to actually go and look after more clients. The first one we spoke about, the Zoom.
Yep.
The second one is AI.
Yep.
So rather than sort of sitting there for an hour, not that I ever sat there for an hour, but compliance might have tapped me on the shoulder and said, your file notes need to have a bit more detail, right? You simply record the meeting as you do it. It produces the file note. It takes you 10 minutes to go through, add stuff, delete stuff, whatever needs to happen. It produces a follow-up email to the client and the back office team, and that's all that's done.
It's the most wonderful gift.
It's amazing.
And in a second, I'm going to ask you about the technology stack that you guys have got, whether you're agnostic or not. But I'll just sort of circle on that. And I think that it's probably been a year or so for most people who are using sort of a file noting and AI. My darling wife is in a different industry. She's in medical industry and she has consults and they've got a piece of software called HeidiScribe, which is like a medical specific recording thing. And just about 2 weeks ago, it did the yearly wrap up, a bit like a Spotify wrap up for the year. And it came and said, your usage last year saved you an average of 5.4 hours a day. A day.
Yeah.
And I said, and she goes, well, I was still doing the patient work before, but why do you think I was working on weekends to backfill it, right? So it's been a genuine thing. And look, we just use the Copilot in my other businesses, but it's been a tremendous benefit. You've got to use it, right?
Yeah.
But that's kind of, I suppose that's it. But let's talk about the technology then that your overall license is doing. Do you prescribe any sort of financial planning software?
We do. We use Xplan at the moment. And then a few years ago, we decided.
God, the amount of times I've heard that line. If you're listening, they don't even mean to say it. So
Well, to be fair to Iris, they've made that rod for their own back. I think they realize that everyone's eating their lunch now, but I would suggest maybe the damage is done. However, one of the things we did try a couple of years ago was we tried to get one of the, we did a trial with one of the new up and coming platforms, new tech, blah, blah, blah. And unfortunately that didn't pan out. So we had to put that on the back.
Why? What was the lesson?
They ran out of money.
Fuck, I knew you were going to say that.
And that was always the risk.
It sucks, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because the good ideas, good people, they just don't have enough backing.
But to me, and we were like one of their bigger sort of people.
Well, if you're all in, 60 odd people's not.
Well, we weren't all in. We were sort of doing it piecemeal. They wanted us to do it all in. And I said, well, I'm not doing that until it's done.
Well, in retrospect.
It's working.
But, yeah.
But basically what they were trying to do is they were trying to solve world poverty in one day. And I said, well, let's just start with one city. Let's just solve poverty for that one city, and then we'll move to the next one. Because if people can see that it's worked for this one thing, that gives people confidence to then give them the time to. But if you're trying to do 20 things and you're not achieving any of them, it makes it a bit hard.
Yeah, so a lesson there with tech, and I'm guilty as well, is you've probably got more confidence over someone in tech who goes, we're really good at one or two things. That's all we're going to do.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're natural optimists. So
in saying that, to me, the tech piece is a big piece.
Yep. So where's it going now?
We're using 1980s technology. We're using an electronic filing cabinet, right? We need a better solution.
A double tape to record.
Okay. So what we need is we need to embrace technology. Absolutely. But it's, because we're all waiting for this magic bullet that does everything, I sort of think that, we're probably not making the progress we need to. In saying that, we've got together with we're looking at a new person, new party, which I won't sort of say who that is at this point because it's commercially sensitive. And they actually have an end-to-end system, which is new tech. It is already working. It is already functioning. And that even feeds through to platforms and what have you. So
the good thing about your business is you can guinea pig yourself.
Correct.
First, and your rest of your sort of advisors know that you're going to be running into the fire. And then you'll turn around afterwards rather than them being the guinea pigs.
Correct. And that's exactly what happens, right? But this gets back to the original concept of being a license, right?
Yep.
Well, we've got the ability to go do that, and we do that for everyone else. Whereas if we're running our own show and just for ours, if we went out and tried everything, like we wouldn't be doing too much client work.
Yeah.
And that's the problem, right?
And I see practices where they've just fallen in love with that. And that's the tech stack. So, and I imagine that would be trialed with yourself. Then you'll have your own back office, your own paraplanners. You're kind of building a best of breed, as you insinuated. You mentioned that you've got a potential succession for when people are exiting their business, which is a purchase or part purchase or whatever it is. Do you have many younger advisors in your network as principals? Second question, have you got any that are looking to bring PYs on in the future?
Look, to me, I don't really want to go down the path of having a financial services industry rant. But one of the things that I think annoys a lot of people about this industry is that the regulators, the lawmakers, they do things without thinking things through about what's the second and third derivatives. Now, in my opinion, having the banks in the ecosystem was not a bad thing. Sure, they did some bad things, but that could have been reprimanded and fixed up. The Commonwealth Bank Balance Fund never blew anyone up. All right. The other thing that the institutions used to do when people like us, Roxy, were starting out is they'd give you a start.
Yeah.
They'd say, here's a slab of clients, you know.
And you couldn't break things because they were very conservative.
Correct.
Yeah.
But you're 25, you've got no money, you've got no nothing, and away you go. And you can get through those years of building up. And now we have got no one like the AMPs or whoever to back younger people, all those business transitions. And the other thing is, when something does go horribly wrong, i.e. the Guardian thing, right, in the old days, the banks, for all their sins, they used to clean up their own mess.
Yeah.
Right? It didn't fall on the industry. There is no big players left.
Yeah.
And now we've all seen what this bloody scheme of last resort or whatever they call it this week is.
We've got an interesting thing. We're managing $3 or $4 trillion of Australian Super, and more than 60% of it is managed by businesses that, if you compare them against banks, would be considered cottage. And it's the biggest pool of money in our history managed by the smallest, and it doesn't give the consumers protection, as you've indicated, because there's only so much. So getting back to your current one, and by the way, when you said industry rant, I've done about 10 of these podcasts with AFSL heads, and only 10 out of 10 have done an industry rant about the government's misstepping on bringing new advisors in. So I don't think you're any different to the rest.
Good.
And so does that mean that your practices, how are they looking to do their own succession there?
Okay, so going back to, your original question, PY.
Yeah.
Right. Here's the trouble for one- and two-person firms. They can't physically afford it to do it. What's actually involved in bringing these advisors on is economically not viable for a small business. It has been designed for institutions.
Which are out.
Which don't exist.
Yeah.
Well done, geniuses.
So I learned
my trade before I went to that firm in Sydney. I went and did 6 months with AMP.
Yep.
Just so I knew what superannuation was.
Yep. Yeah, and PYs, it's just tough, right? And so there's a big talent squeeze, and you know, if you're listening out there, you're probably going, yeah, I know it's very tough. So, and there's no silver bullet solution for that as we speak.
No.
So what you're saying is that your practices within your license, are they learning to become more specialized in what they do to differentiate themselves? Because it's hard to grow an organically large business like one step at a time. Do you have many practices that are quite specialized in your network?
Yeah, we do. We have a number of people who are very specialized. And one of those businesses has done wonderfully well. They specialize in military personnel.
Okay.
And actually, the paraplanner is actually starting her PY this year.
Right. There you go. Right. Hallelujah.
There's a positive story.
Okay.
Right. But yeah, we do have some people. We got one firm in particular that specializes in, the estate planning, succession aspects. That tends to be probably more of the higher net wealth end. But we're getting more and more people that are sort of looking at that. In regards to what I've also done at Chartreux is I'm of the firm believer that you should not have people walking out of your door into another door for any other reason if you can avoid it. So what I've encouraged, what we've actually got is we've got a network of advisors in our network who specialize in certain expertise.
Yep.
And we make that available to the other advisors. So when they're sitting there talking to a client and they're going, oh, well, I've got this issue and that, rather than saying, I can't help you, there's nothing I can do, and then they walk out and they go somewhere else, you say, I've got the solution. I've got someone who can help us with that. And the client doesn't actually care how their problem gets solved. They just want it solved. And more often than not, the facilitator of the solving of that problem gets more kudos than the actual person that does it.
So I'm going to ask a question without notice because, over the years, I've always lamented that you go to your GP and they refer to whoever does the job, right? And what you're intimating is that if you've got a client who's coming through you and they need aged care, you're not an aged care specialist, refer them.
Correct.
What's been irritating has been that if you go outside of that license, so say I take on a client and charge them a fee and I have to do all the requirements under that license and that ASIC, and then the new person who gets that has to then do all those requirements again, there's a real duplication and the client's quite frictionful. So have you got anything in place where I'm licensed through Chartreux and I've identified that there's my client needs to see someone else who's also licensed through Chartreux? Have you removed any of the friction or any of the privacy consents, or is that something you've thought about?
Yeah, no, absolutely. We've done that. We've also got...
So let's just slow down because that doesn't always happen. So are you saying that they don't have to then do a full FAFO and I can send across information?
Well, they're in the same network, the same license. So that's easy. And even if they're in a different license, which is my next point, we have a B2B solution for UK pensions. So we specialise in a lot of UK pension work.
Yep.
Right? So Matt, who runs that business, has a lot of people referring business in from other advisory businesses. And we're not actually under the same license as them, but we're actually sitting in on the same meetings where we're helping solve a problem for that advisor and their client. And basically all we do in those situations is we're getting the client gives us authority for us to talk to each other and to exchange information, and that's all that's required.
Well, and that's wonderful to have that sort of removing of that, because it just makes it more logical. Now, we wanted to talk about high performance and the good people at PM Capital. They've asked me to ask people around how they identify high performance in practices, and what are the kind of, so you've said you've got some practices, you mentioned some that are specialized, but for someone who's been around, for someone who gets basically out of free look at 60 advisors every day, what differentiates high performers versus the average run of the mill?
Okay, so to be a high performance advice business, I think you've got to do two things. You've got to have great outcomes for your clients, and you've got to have a profitable business.
And let's assume the great outcomes is a great one, but let's double down on the second one. So what do you mean by profitable? I understand what profit is, but
30-40% margin.
30-40% margin?
Yep.
And where do you see people making errors who don't achieve that?
They've got old business models.
Yep.
They've got no one does this like me, so I'm going to do it myself, or I'm going to do this.
Hark back to what you said initially.
Correct.
Yep.
Yeah. The thing I've learned over, I guess, not so much my advising career, but actually building a business, is you've got to let go. If you don't have scale in a business, you've got nothing. And that's the thing that I've learned. You've got to have good people around you. You've got to you've got to have an infrastructure that enables the job to get done efficiently. And when I say efficiently, it's time, it's cost. And everyone, whenever they're doing anything, should be asking themselves, should I be doing this?
Yeah, right person, right time, right thing. Yep.
Whenever I do something, I go, should I be doing this or should I be have someone else do this?
Yeah.
Is this a Rob job or is this someone else's job? And to me, if an advisory firm is doing the right thing and they got the right structures, they're the sorts of behaviors that they have.
And on that same topic, so hold that thread of thought. Do you guys have your own SMA or MDA or investment management committee? See, you're nodding. Nodding doesn't translate, Rob. It's a podcast.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
Oh.
No. So you've got both of those.
So I guess we do.
Yep.
Part of the Chartreux way is how we manage investments.
And that also leads into the profitability as well, right? Running a profit.
Well, it leads into the – well, it does. So coming back to the two prongs. Profitability for the advisor. Outcomes for the client. So the way – having gone through the tech rec, the GFC, these sorts of things, there was lessons that I learned. And what I learned was basically if you're doing what everyone else is doing, that doesn't make the clients feel any better when you've told them that they've just lost a whole heap of dough, all right?
That's right.
So our investment management is around about risk-adjusted investing and yada, yada, yada. So that's how we go about doing what we do, and that's a path we go down with the client saying, look, if you want to do it this way, this is what it means, and these are the alternatives. But in the end, most people are the same. They go, look, all I want to do is I want to make sure I've got enough retirement, money in my retirement. I don't necessarily want to see big swings, and I just want to keep up with inflation. That's all they're trying to do.
So over the period of time where you guys have got your investment management committee, you're setting up an SMA, whatnot, is it?
MDA. We use an MDA.
MDA, yeah.
We use an MDA and we love self-managed super funds because we don't want trustees telling us what we can and can't do.
Right.
Because quite frankly, I'm sick of hearing advice from those people. We will advise the client on whatever is best for them and their circumstances. And if that involves holding 20% in gold, that's what we'll do.
And by doing a lot of self-managed super funds, does that mean that a lot of your practices also do a lot of work of accounting firms, or is it just...
Yeah, there's a bit of that that goes on. Yeah, absolutely.
And so you've got the... you've mentioned how you sort of utilize that MDA, which is, you know, I wish we didn't... I kind of got out of planning before we got into MDAs, right? So on that, is it just a retail license offering, or do you have a wholesale offering with Chartreux?
It's both, yeah.
And what's the breakdown between practices?
We've only got a couple of wholesale only guys.
Okay,
most are retail.
Now, what that says to me, so you've now given me a bit of a picture of what you've got, and you've given me a picture of what you think practices should be who are high performing and the percentage profit, and you know, so typically someone turning over millions making $300,000-$400,000 after paying themselves a normalized income. So what kind of practices, if you could wave your magic wand, would you like to attract over the next 1 to 2 years?
Well, I guess from I'll divide that answer into two. So from a licensing perspective, yeah, we're happy to work with anyone that sees value in what we do and they want to sort of work within the parameters that we work with. I'm more dealing with the best of breed type things at the moment.
You roll the sleeves up yourself as well. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, it gets back to it's the same thing. I've already done it. I've done it five times. I'll just do it again. I'll show them how to do it.
Yep.
You mentioned earlier the best way to learn is from other people's mistakes. Well, I've made them all, right? So you know, we could talk a lifetime about that. So when I'm looking at best of breed, what I'm really after is someone to sort of say, look, I agree with your approach. I agree with how you go about things. Makes perfect sense to me. What do we need to do? That's what I'm after for best of breed.
And so, which is the type of person? But you say you're geographically agnostic. Do you get many advisors coming from large organisations? Because you've been in the Goldilocks. There you go. So you've been in a large organisation, being Westpac and AMP.
Yeah.
You've then gone to the very smallest one, being self-licensed, and now you found yourself somewhere in the middle, Goldilocks.
Yep. Yeah.
Do you get mainly practices coming from other ones like the one you are as far as size, or from self-licensed or from big ones?
No, it's more same.
Right.
Yeah.
And why do they make the move generally? What if-
Oh, look, what I find, most people move licenses because for whatever reason they have to. There's very rarely in my experiences of people just decided, I'm going to start afresh and away I go.
Oh, it's a pain in the ass to move.
Correct.
Yeah.
Right. So to me, there's always a trigger.
Yeah.
Right. And those triggers vary and they're wise and, you know, but, yeah. So that's what, you know, sort of I would sort of say. And the other thing about, you know, talking about advice to people that look for licenses, that's where I always say to people, look, you know, and even if you look at what we're doing, and if that doesn't suit you, that's fine. Don't come with us. Find someone you can work with. Because if you don't, all you're doing is kicking the can down the road and you're going to have to deal with the same problem next time.
Absolutely.
And how much money does that, like people sort of like to talk about, oh, what's your fees relative to those fees? That's a pittance. The amount of time and effort that goes into all the mucking around to transfer licenses and what have you, yeah, you know, what does that add up to? So you don't want to be doing it if you don't have to.
And you just reiterated the why Chartreux Wealth, which is, I'm reading off your website, flat fee structure, common sense compliance, independence and flexibility, comprehensive support and resources, and investment advice. And from what I've heard is that you can, I mean, you can't opt out of the fees, but you can dip in to as far as you want. It's a bit of practicality in my mind. You can lean into the full tilt and do the Chartreux way.
Yep.
Or you can pick and choose, or you might be on a journey, yeah?
Yep.
Interesting. So put you on the spot, because the great thing about podcasts is pretty evergreen, right? So we're here in the beginning of 2026. What would you like to see in 1 year the sort of your business look like as far as numbers?
As in total numbers?
Yeah.
To be honest, not really focused on that.
What are you focused on?
I'm focused on what I want is I want two new firms to embrace Best of Breed. And I want to bed them down.
Okay, so two new firms into the Chartreux way.
Add them to the pot, and that's my personal, because that's my baby. That's what I work with.
Yeah, and also okay, so that's building that profitability, etc. You like others sort of explained the or sort of lamented the government failing in sort of the education levels. If you were to wave a magic wand, right? And you don't get held to this, and this is your thoughts. What would be a couple of the quick fixes to give financial advice, quality, ethical financial advice to more Australians?
I don't think there is a quick fix, but we need to get rid of the red tape. It's too much.
Almost, but there's a lot of that in every facet of Australia.
And that's not good for Australia, and that we're going to have, there's going to be serious consequences for that.
And you're right, because when you mentioned earlier that Commonwealth Bank never blew its balance fund up and there was nothing wrong with that, what needs to be recognised that when a person went into the Commonwealth Bank and met with a Commonwealth Bank planner and got a Commonwealth Bank product, they knew they were doing that.
Yeah.
Right? So this whole kind of, if we can accept that's the case and people are, feel that they have to have this scaffolding for every bad investment decision they've made, it's called risk return.
Yeah.
Look, it doesn't happen in any other vocation, doesn't underwrite. Like you go to a doctor and they go, well, if it doesn't work out, I'm kind of just going to pay for the thing that make it better. It doesn't happen.
My biggest concern for my clients and other clients, retail clients at the moment, is what the legislators and regulators are doing in regards to the management of money. We've already seen this with the heat map. So what the heat map does is, and one of my school friends is a CIO at a big super fund, and he agrees 100% with me, right? And he's front and center. What they're encouraging the industry funds to do is do the same thing. Now, when in human history has stifling innovation ever been a good thing?
Yes, true.
Right? So basically, and when we talk about self-managed super funds and the structures and why we do what we do as a Chartreux way when it comes to investing, clients agree. They go, well, yeah, I just don't want to. If I'm 65 years old and I've got 70% of my overseas money in the US and 40% of that in a handful of tech stocks, how does that help me achieve my objectives? Well, guess what? Everyone's doing that.
Yeah.
Right? So that's what the heat map does now. And then an outcome of this Guardian thing is they're going to come in on trustees, and trustees are going to do similar sorts of things in the private space. and they're going to make everyone invest the same sort of way. Like Macquarie's already done it with their platform. If you're not, you know, if you're not massive, you're not huge, well, you can't be on the platform. And to me, that's an issue. And because what we're doing is we're just looking back and we're saying, oh, the last 30 years is representative of what the next 30 years is going to be. All we have to do is buy an index fund and we're fine. And anyone that says that, I go look at 1968 to 1980 and look at your real returns after inflation and see how index has
gone. Sideways.
You went down.
Yeah.
Inflation-adjusted terms, you went down.
Yeah, and it's so interesting because, you know, as I mentioned, PM Capital sort of we're lend into this, and they're deep value, right? So there's been when you just look at index funds, there's time and a place for them.
Absolutely,
but
it's a tool.
Yeah,
but when you hold a hammer, everything's a nail.
Yeah, that's right.
Right,
that's right.
Paul Moore. I have had money with him since 2000, right? I think he's the best fund manager in the country.
Oh, no, you hang up. They'll be loving that. Don't worry. Whenever sort of bubbles go out, then value remains, right? So
yeah.
This is not an investment podcast, and don't take anything, listeners, that I say, because I'm not licensed anymore as gospel. But what I've just wanted to sort of finalize or with yourself is the deep passion of yourself, right? So for those listening, what you got in the last sort of hour or so is what the guy is. Okay, you're going to get this passion and this intensity if you're just sharing a coffee or a chat. If you're interested in sort of just reviewing where you're at, I'm pretty sure that you'd be happy to have a chat with them. You seem to be pretty good on the chat, Rob. They can reach out to Kieran. Kieran, we can put some links in. Actually, you can't reach out to Kieran. He doesn't know anything about whether or not you're a good financial planner, but he will put the links in. He's just laughing at me. I did mention it's a Friday afternoon recording, everyone. And the other facets of what I know, we're having other conversations about business growth, and you've got a choice. Don't chop and change. Sort of find out your people, and you're not going to be for everyone.
No.
But you've got that target of doing it, and you actually also have said something really profound and not wishy-washy is you're saying that you want to drive profit.
Yep.
So good practices make good profit. And if you're making good profit, you can look at your partner and your kids in the eye, and you can actually do the goal setting that you do for your clients. If you're not,
correct,
you're kind of just going through the motions, right? So, and you need a little bit of that accountability.
We got to listen to what we shovel, right? We're telling our clients to do it. We've got to do it.
Exactly. So on behalf of Ensemble, it's licensees come in all shapes and sizes, and they are, it's worth considering. I think you've said if you're self-licensed, consider. If you're big, consider. If you figure out who your people are, you can stick to it. I've had a look at your website. Looks like you have some pretty good fun on your conferences. And I bet they'll be hilarious. I think that one is at Queenstown, the last one?
Queenstown, the last one. Port Douglas, end of March.
You heard it here first. So
board shorts and golf sticks.
Perfect. So, Rob, thanks very much, not just for this, but for all the other things we're doing. It's always great to interview very down-to-earth people, and thanks for being part of the Ensemble Licensee podcast series, mate.
Thanks for the opportunity, Roxy.
Cheers, mate.